Hi, Ira here. It's that time of the year, sleigh bells, hot chocolate, and appeals for money. At Science Friday, we depend on your donations. So if you can, please consider making a gift. It's simple. Just head over to sciencefriday.com and click on the donate link. We hope you like this week's show, and to show our appreciation for your support, we've dipped into our archives and have lined up a special broadcast. Classic interview with Carl Sagan and Temple Grandin. I think you're really going to appreciate it. Have a happy holiday. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Are you tweeting this year? You know, years ago, the word tweet meant something to do with birds, right? You tweeted. People were tweet birds would tweet. Well, this being Christmas right around the corner, that means the annual Audubon Christmas Bird Count. Every year since 1900, volunteers have flocked to the fields to survey birds, drink hot chocolate, perhaps some other beverages. Last year, over 70,000 people counted over 60 million birds, 2,300 different species. Wow, what birds have you seen this winter? Are you out there at the count? Are you counting the birds along with the Audubon Society? Are you having trouble IDing a bird you saw? Maybe we can help you out identifying that bird. Do you have a favorite birding spot that you'd like to share with us? We want to hear from you, so give us a call. Our number, 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. And you can tweet us the new way, at SciFry, at SCIFRI. Before we begin, here's a quick test before we bring on our guests. I'm going to play a clip of a bird, and if you think you know what it is, give us a call, and extra points if you can give us the Latin name of the bird. Here it is. That sounds so nice. It makes you feel so calm. Let me bring on Jeff LeBaron. He's the Christmas Bird Count Director for the National Audubon Society. He's based out of Williamsburg, Massachusetts. He joins us from WFCR in Amherst. Welcome to Science Friday. Welcome back.
It's great to be back on the show, Ira.
That bird was not hard for you to identify, I'm sure, and you will keep it a secret.
We will, although I'll say I did hear some yesterday morning. So.
Oh, you did? Yeah. Let's give out our number, 1-800-989-8255. Again, you can also tweet us at SciFry. We're coming up on the second week of the count. How's it going this year?
I think it's going quite well. I know that we had some issues here in the Northeast with weather last weekend, and I actually was 0-for-2 on the counts that I would have done. But I'll be out tomorrow down in Rhode Island, and I'm really looking forward to a day out in the field.
All right. Being out there in Western Mass, what birds have you seen in your area?
Well, I haven't managed to find a snowy owl yet this year, unlike a lot of people on the coast. But the other day here in Hadley, I did actually see a short-eared owl, which was my first one of the year, and it's always a pleasure to see those. Mm-hmm. We've got things like snow buntings around, other things like what was singing yesterday morning are around. And it's just a fun time of year to get out and discover what's moving around.
Well, let's talk about the snowy owl, because I think last year we said there was a record movement of snowy owls. Is that continuing?
It's a really interesting situation this year in that for the third year in a row, we have had a large movement of snowy owls. 2 years ago, it was actually a broad front movement across southern Canada and the northern United States. Last year, it was an even bigger movement into the Pacific Northwest and sort of British Columbia and places like that. And this year, we're having a record flight here in the Northeast. There are incredible numbers of snowy owls at some locations on the coast, and it's amazing and very interesting and a little bit of a mystery as to why it's been happening for 3 years in a row.
Well, anything that might do with climate change? They're moving different places?
It could be. It is more likely that they're, at least the direct cause is probably has to do with what's happening to their food supplies up in the Arctic, which one of their primary things that they eat is the lemmings. And lemmings have a real cyclical population where they numbers increase and increase and then crash. And in years when they've got more lemmings, you get more owls. And when those populations crash, then the owls need to move to find food.
1-800-989-8255. Let me take a quick phone call here from Robert in New York. Hi, Robert.
How you doing, Ira?
Hi there.
Okay, I just want to mention something about the snowy white owls. They've been killing them over the airports in New York City because they said they're getting in the way of the planes like the geese.
No kidding.
And I can't believe that they're doing it because, I mean, they're beautiful. And they, I mean, they're not that many of them that's going to be flying that much in the way of a jet plane.
Jeff, have you heard about that?
I heard this on, and this has been, I think it's over LaGuardia specifically, and then over JFK.
I've definitely heard about it. I believe that stopped.
I hope so.
A lot of the, largely due to the actions of Audubon and local chapters and a lot of outcry on the bird listservs, they did decide to do what actually has been done for decades at Logan Airport in Boston, right, which is to do non-lethal methods of basically just encouraging them to be away from the runways, but also if you get a bird that just hangs out near the runway, they capture it and then relocate it.
Robert, have you seen one of those birds yourself?
No, I've seen, when I was younger, I saw them upstate. I used to go upstate when I was younger, yeah, and I saw them upstate, but that was, 50 years ago.
Yeah. Are you still a bird watcher?
I live in New York City, and you know the only birds I watch are pigeons, swifts, and sparrows. That's the only thing I see around here. Once in a blue moon, I see a parrot.
Oh, yeah, there are a lot of parrots. And,
you know, I mean, flying around, yeah, even in the street. Like, I'm on the Upper West Side.
Wow. In Brooklyn, they're all over, I understand.
There's a lot. Yeah, I heard that there's... Why is there parrots in Brooklyn, by the way?
Let me ask Jeff again. Thanks for the call. Jeff, why are there parrots in Brooklyn?
Well, the parrots that are in New York City are monk parakeets, and they're actually released pets from years and years ago. And despite what you might think about parrots being sort of tropical birds, which in general they are, they're perfectly able to survive in cold conditions. And as long as there's food around, they can do quite well. And in the cities, they get sort of protection in some areas, and, mm-hmm, and there are actually some pretty good populations around. So I did want to mention about the snowy owls. There's actually a really cool feature on the Audubon Magazine online website where Ken Kaufman has sort of answered a bunch of what are those 12 more popular questions about snowy. So it's a pretty interesting thing.
Is there any one bird you want people to keep an eye out for this year?
Well, this year, we want people to, for the Christmas count, to count everything they see and hear. I mean, that's right, sort of the what it's all about. And the rare things like snowy owls or unusual birds are the ones that get the birders out there and hoping they'll find them. But while they're out there, they're actually counting all the house sparrows and monk parakeets and starlings and chickadees and everything else that's around. And by them doing that, then we get this wonderful long-term database that we can look at what's happening with the birds across the continent over time. But it's just the whole concept of citizen science is really taken off, largely in part to programs like the Christmas Bird Count and everybody that does them, and we're starting to learn a tremendous amount about the birds, including things like the monk parakeets, because we're able to track how they're doing over time in these metropolitan areas.
I understand, though, you've been asking people to keep an eye out for banded loggerhead shrikes.
Right. Recently there's a project going on in Canada where there's a small breeding population of loggerhead shrikes, and they move southward into the United States to spend the winter. And we have a form on the Christmas Bird Count website that's not just appropriate for during the CBC, but mm-hmm, actually during the whole winter season, where if people do see a loggerhead shrike that's been banded, they have color bands on them, so you can actually get a little bit of an individual idea of where the bird was and exactly where it came from, and they can report those back up to the people in Canada. Mm-hmm. So it's a new project that we're involved with this year or helping with this year, and it'll be pretty exciting to see what happens.
Speaking of exciting projects, I want to bring on another guest to talk about a project that will let everybody count the birds right in their own backyard. Emma Gregg is the project leader for Cornell University's Project Feeder Watch. She joins us from the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology in Ithaca, New York. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
What is the goal of Project Feeder Watch?
Well, it's actually very similar in overall goal to the Christmas Bird Count. The goal is to keep track of changes in bird populations across North America. And so there are about 20,000 people now per year who participate, and it's in both Canada and the United States. And we ask them to count the birds that they see out their front window at their feeders or bird baths between the months of November and April. And so the goal is to just ask folks to help us keep track of different species of birds throughout the continent.
And how do they report that back?
Well, we have a protocol that we ask people to follow so that everybody is counting birds in the same way. Mm. And that's what makes it a data set that's easy for scientists to then go back and use to really understand how bird populations are changing.
So how can I be part of this?
Well, the easiest thing to do is to go to the website. It's feederwatch.org, and there are some really clear red buttons that show you where to click if you want to sign up. And then we'll send you a research kit that has some starting materials if you're not very familiar with the birds in your backyard. We try and help you out with a poster of common feeder birds, instructions for how to count. And then to submit your counts, the best way to do it is just on our website. There's a little place where you can enter in the numbers that you see at your feeders and then see graphs of the changes in bird populations at your own home. So we try to make it as easy as possible for as many people to participate as want to.
If you want to set up a bird feeder in your backyard, what's the easiest way to do it? And let me just rephrase that and say, what kind of bird food should you put in there?
Well, the most popular bird food from a bird's perspective is black oil sunflower seed. Most birds just love it, and I think that's because it's a oily, fatty seed, and they know what's delicious, and so they really enjoy that. So that's a great one to use. And thistle, little black thistle seeds are also great for attracting lots of small finches and sparrows and things like that. So those are a couple good ones, but I'll say that we just put a new little tool on the site that allows you to choose a common feeder bird, and then using data that's been collected by feeder watchers over the years, this program says, well, what kind of feeders and seeds are popular for that species? And this is called our common feeder bird tool. So it's kind of fun to click around and see what you might attract in your yard, given the feeders that you have, or see what you might need to offer if there's something in particular you really want to see, like a pygmy nuthatch or a goldfinch or something like that.
See a lot of nuthatches at my bird feeder station. Speaking of finches, I know that you're monitoring something called house finch eye disease. Tell us about that.
That's right. This is something that Project Feeder Watchers actually discovered in 1994. So it's been around for a long time, but this disease since then has spread from the Washington, D.C. area where it began to all across North America. And so we don't have a really good handle right now on exactly where it is and where it is not. And so this year we're really encouraging feeder watchers to look for this eye disease in house finches and report whether or not they see six finches. And importantly, to report if they look but don't see six finches, because we really want to know where it is, but also where it isn't yet.
And how do scientists use this stuff that we send them?
Well, they use it to understand, in this case, where the disease is moving, how fast it's spreading, and also how prevalent it is. So maybe it's in a location, but are all the house finches infected? Are none of them infected? And so using data collected in a really standardized way allows biologists to answer those questions in a very robust way.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR, talking with Emma Grieg about the Feeder Watch program. And this is a very simple thing to do. You know, I think people who don't watch or are not bird watchers, once they set up their first bird feeder, they get hooked. We heard a gentleman from New York saying he saw, you know, some sparrows and some, well, the New York bird, the pigeon. But there are a lot more birds out there once you set up the feeder, aren't there? You discover how many more kinds of birds there are.
It's true. Feeders are just like a magnet for what's around your home anyway. And so it's a great way to get birds to come into your view so you can actually keep track of them. And we really try to help folks learn how to identify birds that they maybe aren't familiar with yet. And so we've got some little things on the website called Tricky Bird ID pages to help folks figure out what's what. And it's always fun when people send photos to us to try and identify for them. So we want folks who, even if you don't feel like you're a really experienced birder, to give stuff like this a try, because it's easy for everyone to learn the real common ones, we want to help.
Yeah, I came to this later in life, and I really enjoy bird watching. So thank you, Emma, and have a happy holiday. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Emma Gregg is the project leader at Cornell University's Project Feeder Watch. She joined us from Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology. That's up there in Ithaca, New York. We asked you, well, at the beginning of the program, if you could name this bird. All right, let's see. We have a few people who think they can identify the bird. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Zach in McKeesport, Pennsylvania.
Hey, hey, how you doing, sir? Big yeah. fan of Science Friday.
Thank you.
But yeah, my I live with my grandpa, and he has been feeding birds for, you know, as long as I can remember. So I'm pretty sure I can nail this one.
Go ahead.
Being from Southwest Pennsylvania, it is an albatross.
Is it?
Right?
No.
I'm just kidding. It's an oriole.
No.
It's not an oriole? I thought I had that.
Strike two. Okay. All right. Well, thank you, Zach, for trying. And happy holiday to you. 1-800-989-8255. Let's go for another. Let's go to Milwaukee. Certainly Deborah in Milwaukee must know the answer.
Well, I certainly hope so. I'm thinking it's the American robin.
The American. I wish I had my bell. What happened to my bell? Yes, it is the American robin. Do you know the Latin name for it?
Well, I believe that would be Turdus migratorius.
Wow, double. I wish we had a prize to give you.
No, I just love birds, and my favorite bird song is the thrush, actually, which is, I believe, a robin is in the same family, but it's, you don't hear it very often, but it's because they hang out in the woods, but it's an unremarkable looking bird, but the song is just so exquisite. I have so many bird. We have a bird bath. You know, I don't have a bird feeder, but I have a bird bath and a cherry tree I planted 20 years ago, and it is hilarious. I have so much footage of bird fights at the bird bath. It's just so fun. I love it.
Is it frozen yet?
Yes, but, you know, the previous owners of this house had a little heater for it, and so I'm thinking of moving it
so
it can be plugged in at the side of the house.
Wow, that's great. It's enjoyable all winter long. And you feed them what do you feed your birds?
Well, I know they love sunflowers, but we have neighbors that have a plethora of, but they have at least 20 bird feeders, and birds are spoiled. So that's where they go to eat, and then they come over here and take a bath.
They hang out. Great. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much, Deborah. This is terrific.
Thank you for the program.
You're welcome. Happy holiday. We're going to take a break and come back and talk lots more about bird feeding with Jeff LeBaron, who is a Christmas bird count director at the National Audubon Society. If you're out there and you got a cell phone and you're counting the birds along with Greg and the folks, give us a call, 1-800-989-8255. You can also tweet us. Sounds weird today. At SciFry, SCIFRI. We'll be right back. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto. We're talking this hour about the annual Audubon Christmas bird count. Give us a call with your birding questions, tips, things you've spotted. My guest is Jeff LeBaron. He is Christmas bird count director of the National Audubon Society. And the tweets are coming in. You have a tweet from Karen Kogod, who says, "We had a beautiful, huge, snowy owl in our yard 3 weeks ago." There you go, Jeff. Someone has got a nice snowy owl.
That's a great yard bird.
Yeah. Let's go to the phones. 1-800-989-8255. Nick in Miami. Hi, Nick.
Hi. Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask your guest his opinion. I believe this is the third winter now that I've noticed an American kestrel in my backyard. He seems to just kind of come in and hang out sort of around my yard and then our neighbor's yards. And I was, I did a little bit of research, and what I found out was that they are known to migrate back to the same spot for breeding purposes. But I'm pretty sure I've only ever seen the one bird, never a pair. And I was wondering if your guests could field that question.
Well, kestrels are definitely migratory, and a lot of migratory birds not only have territories in the breeding season during the summer up here, but also when they go where they go in the winter, they'll actually oftentimes return to exactly the same place in the winter. I've actually, on one of the Christmas counts that I do down in Rhode Island, I've had one, what's clearly the same individual, lesser blackback gull, that's come back to exactly the same rock and exactly the same cove for 13 years now.
Wow.
And so I think that what might be what you're seeing is down there, you probably get them mostly in the winter. And
right.
your bird's coming back, you know, because he knows he's got a good place, he or she, to spend the winter. And if it works, you just keep doing it. So it's great for you to have that bird there, because actually kestrels are declining pretty significantly across the country.
Oh, wow.
For reasons that aren't totally understood, but part of it has to do with they nest in cavities in trees. So there have been issues with not enough nesting areas for them, but also it may have to do with overuse of pesticides, which takes down a lot of the insects that they eat. So,
right, okay. And what would, out of curiosity, what are the typical lifespan for a kestrel?
I'm actually not sure exactly on kestrels. I would suspect they're not. I don't know if they're real long-lived birds. I wouldn't think so. Like some things like parrots and jays and stuff like that can live a long time, but maybe 5 to 8 years, something like that, for okay. an adult bird.
So you have some time left, Nick, with your
good.
Pet.
Yeah, no, I really enjoy having him around. So hopefully he'll come back and see us next year.
Yeah, thanks for calling. Good luck to you.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Bye-bye.
Welcome. Jeff, sometimes birds get lost, and they wind up in places where they really aren't supposed to be.
It does happen. That's one of the things that gets people out on Christmas counts or just out birding in general, is the hope to find something that's in your area and not supposed to be there. But there's a certain percentage of birds that are migratory for any migratory species that are going to go in the wrong direction when they're supposed to go, either 90 or 180 degrees the wrong direction. But also weather patterns can actually push birds off path or out of range. And we're starting to see more and more hummingbirds in the northern parts of the continent during the winter. And there's a lot of sort of interest in what's happening with hummingbirds.
Tell me about that, because that's the one bird I have not been able to attract to my yard yet.
But at all?
Not at all. Well, you know, I haven't tried hard enough, because I gave up after about 5 years of putting out the right plants and the red sugar water and stuff. But I'll go back to it.
You should, because actually they're oftentimes, it may take a while for them to actually find your yard, but once they've found it, if you've got hummingbird feeders out, they'll continue to come, and they'll, you know, the young grow up and they know that was a good place. Audubon has a new project also called Hummingbirds at Home, where we're hoping to actually track how the nectar source hummingbird interactions and in the long run come up with recommendations for people to make their yards even better for hummingbirds.
All right, let's go to Bloomfield, New Jersey. Go to Lynette. Is it Lynette?
It's Lynette. Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I very much want to have a bird feeder and engage in all of this, but I have an indoor-outdoor house cat, and I was wondering sort of about the ethics of all that.
What do you do if you have a cat that lives outside?
There are things that you can do to make it harder for predators in general to get to birds at feeders. You don't want them too low. They need to be near cover but not right next to it, and things like that. So if there are cats outside, whether it's your cat or a neighbor's cat, by doing things like that, you can at least reduce the number of birds that they're going to take.
I just get the sensation that I'm setting a trap.
If the cat's out there a lot, I mean, it's actually best to try to keep them indoors. But if you do have cats that are around in the neighborhood, then if they're just a constant presence, then maybe sometimes it's best not to put feeders out. Or if you have if you can do it so it's on a second floor, on a second floor window or something like that, then that helps with the situation as well.
All right. Good luck
to you.
Thanks for the call. We got time for a couple of more calls. 1-800-989-8255. Shannon in Indianapolis. Hi, Shannon.
Actually, I'm calling from Annapolis, Maryland, but that's okay.
I don't.
No worries. I'm calling because there is advertised on TV, there's a bird house, the back wall of which is plexiglass, and it has suction cups on the birdhouse, and the idea is that you attach it to a window in your home, and then supposedly you can kind of see what goes on inside a birdhouse. And I wondered whether, A, you all think that birds would actually use something like that, knowing that they can, see a human right there, and B, whether it doesn't, maybe it's not a good kind of environment for birds at all.
Yeah. I've seen those little birdhouse things.
There's a huge amount of curiosity that people have about what birds are doing in their nests. And there are bird cams, actually, sometimes in some places where you know, nature centers and stuff have a nest box outside. But I've heard of this also, and it's one of those things that it's probably not going to harm the birds. If the birds elect to nest in there, they've accepted the fact that if they can see through the glass, and sometimes they don't actually see inside through the glass very well. But if they said, okay, well, I'm going to use this, and it's a cavity, and it's a place where they want to do, then it's probably not going to bother them, and it might be a wonderful educational opportunity, especially if you've got kids.
Okay.
But it could be the kind of a thing where it's just unlikely to get used, too, because they tend to not want to nest in areas where it's too exposed, and I think a window on the side of a building might fit that bill.
All right, one last question from John in Indian River, Michigan. Hi, John.
Hi, I love your show.
Thank you.
I got a question I haven't heard addressed. I know species, and I feed birds most of my life, and I've got probably a dozen different species. But as far as a bird count, at times this thing is like Grand Central Station. I've got them coming and going. How do you know? It's not like they wear name tags or anything.
Well, good question.
Supposed to count the number of species, or
how do you count the birds? Yeah, what if they count them twice, or is that all even out in the long run somehow?
The idea is not to count them twice. For feeder watch and for the Christmas count, for people that are watching their feeders, what the method is, if you're a stationary observer watching a given place, you keep track of the species that are coming in, and what you do is you count the number of birds that you see at one, the maximum number you see at one time. So if you get two or three chickadees coming in all day, you don't keep counting the same two or three chickadees overall. But if at some point you see five chickadees at once, then that's the number that you actually submit.
It seems like I got a dozen of them just waiting until the other ones get off, and then the titmice, and then some of the other birds that are out there are wanting to crowd in on it. But that's useful information. I appreciate that.
All right. Thanks for calling,
sure.
John.
It's always fun to watch them.
Yeah, and Jeff, you'll be watching them all winter?
I will, and hopefully 50 to 70,000 other people will. The Christmas count has just been a wonderful thing for a long time, and it's growing in importance, really. And I want to thank everybody that's been doing it for all the years, because without everybody's efforts, it wouldn't continue to be the successful program, and we wouldn't be able to learn as much as we have been. Over the last decades about what's happening.
Well, we wish you good luck and a happy holiday.
Happy holiday to you.
Jeff LeBaron is the Christmas Bird Count Director for the National Audubon Society.